From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Thasmia.
And we'll be your host for the next half hour of environmental news from across Canada and around the world.
Just like how we can't be sure what it really means if a company says it's green or all natural, we'll explore the similar ambiguity of another food label.
And if you've been wondering about that something-something that makes writing electric, whatever the subject, we've got just a discussion for you.
But first, if this summer has been a scorcher for you with no sign of stopping, here's a breezy way for you to cool down.
Ben Kaplan is a singer-songwriter hailing from Halifax, Nova Scotia. A few years back, he helped organize a local event for World Naked Bike Ride. Since this is the sort of thing you only want to do in the heat of the summer, Trevor Chow Fraser asked Ben to help put together a little how-to guide for hosting a naked bike ride in your town. But just a warning, there is some coarse language. My foot to the pedal, slipping in a basket. No helmet, so maybe I'll end up in a casket. Prematurely, yo, knock on oak abdominal.
Rocket on spokes, resting a rubber by continental. So, Jack, I wanted to talk today about getting naked and riding a bike.
Yeah, great. 31 years old, still don't have my driver's license for real. So,
the automobile and big ups to all those people pushing those two wheels. We're speaking today with Ben Kaplan. He's a Canadian musician, and like many other Canadian indie musicians, he actually spends most of his work time in Europe. But when he's home in Halifax, he gets up to all kinds of fun. A few years ago, that included helping organize the annual World Naked Bike Ride. Halifax hosted its sixth ride this past week, and Ben Kaplan happened to be passing through Edmonton at the same time. So I caught up with him to ask what this naked bike ride thing is all about.
Getting to ride my bike naked. You know, all the politics aside, I mean, I think it's an important thing. I think that raising awareness around issues of bike culture and bike infrastructure and, you know, creating safe spaces for bikers in cities and creating awareness among drivers and how to react around bikers, all of those things are important. But the naked bike ride is just... it's a fun way of celebrating bike culture, of being politically active in a way, and just sort of moving some of those issues along.
So, sustainable transportation, road safety, bike culture. If these causes all sound great to you, are you ready to help organize a naked bike ride in your town? Well, I'm not, but Ben thinks I should be. And he's agreed to help guide us through the process of organizing a naked bike ride. So if we want to take that leap, we'll be ready for it. Step 1. The naked bike ride has got to be a party. So the first step is to find a venue to use as your launch pad.
So you helped organize a naked bike ride.
Yeah, I helped provide a venue for the start of the ride and the end of the ride. And I guess, I'm not sure how it's done in other cities, but you know, it was nice for the ride that I was involved in to have a place for everybody to get together beforehand, to sort of congregate, prepare themselves, strip down to whatever level they felt was appropriate, and then head off. I think a big part of it was, you know, we put posters all around town and we posted when people could start gathering and when the ride would start and the location at which things would start. And we had a DJ, I think his name was DJ Dick Out. So DJ Dick Out was mixing some tunes on, we actually have a stage in my backyard, so he was up on the stage with a little DJ setup. And we just had a party different face painters and stuff like that, body paints were provided, and that was another way of people sort of getting comfortable around the idea of being naked. You know, you cover yourself in paint and it feels a little bit less vulnerable and all that stuff. And it's also just fun, you know, slathering each other in body paint and then just sort of, you know, getting ready to celebrate bicycles and bike culture.
Providing a comfortable space for participants is important in more ways than one. On the surface, it might seem that getting naked is simply a publicity stunt in the name of cycling advocacy. But these aren't supermodels, hired by PETA to bear all for the flashing cameras. These are just people like you and me. So for many who get involved with the Naked Bike Ride, the event also becomes about tackling the issue of negative body image.
I think that, you know, we're surrounded by these images of you know, this idealized, you know, form of perfection, or at least a certain specific idea of what that is. And so many people are hung up on what their bodies look like. And it was amazing to see, you know, as people started arriving, you know, a few people took their clothes off all the way, and some people just sort of stripped down to their underwear. And the more that people saw other people getting totally naked, you could see people relaxing around the idea, and people who had been wandering around in their underwear for 10 minutes just sort of like stepped over to a corner and slipped them off. And I think it was great, because it's so easy to get hung up on different body types until you realize that absolutely everyone's body looks totally different and weird, unless you're part of this like 1% of the supermodel population or whatever it is. So we, the 99%, took off all our clothes and rode around naked.
Okay. Everybody's comfortable, getting into their birthday suits, body painting, having fun. We're overcoming our negative body image. Everything's going easily breezily. Now it's time to hop on your bikes and hit the streets. Of course, at this point, as you're imagining riding naked into the heart of downtown in front of possibly all your neighbors, it might be a good idea to remember exactly why you're doing this. Why are we exposing ourselves again?
Yeah, I think the Naked Bike Ride, it's an interesting ploy. It uses, you know, sensational PR and it catches people's attention to, you know, to see people riding naked down the street. And the metaphor is that, you know, this is how vulnerable bikers are on the road. You know, people look particularly vulnerable when they're naked, but when there's cars zooming all around you, you're just as vulnerable. The thin layer of clothes don't really protect you then if a car is ignoring you and running into you. So the idea is that bikers are important, and that motorists should pay more attention. And it's a way of garnering some media attention around the issue.
All right, okay. Embodied vulnerability. I got it. So we're doing this. Step two. Rally the troops, hop on your bikes, and set out together on a route through the main streets of downtown. You've done everything to be as comfortable as possible before heading out. And you know what? Ben thinks there's every reason you'll feel great the whole ride through.
Well, there's safety in numbers. You know, you feel ridiculous when you're the first person taking your clothes off, and I'm sure I would feel insane if I were to bike down the street naked on my own. But when you're part of a movement, it's sort of like, yeah, this is my body, and this is my bike, and this is, you know, a political gesture, and it felt like that. And so with the Naked Bike Ride, it's all of those wonderful things, but, you know, it's easy to ignore a critical mass. It's much harder to ignore a naked bike ride.
So it's not like a feeling of terror or...
No, I mean, it wasn't. And I think with the Naked Bike Ride, it's, you know, there's a lot of people who chose to leave their underwear on or bikinis and things like that. And that was fine. There was nobody who was like, you're not dedicated enough to the cause, you know. So, you know, I think if anybody's interested in doing a Naked Bike Ride or being involved or starting one up, you know, I think the motto that we were telling people to encourage people to be comfortable was bear as you dare. You know, and so that's fine. If you want to leave your shirt on or your boxers or whatever, you know, that was fine. We encouraged people to just do whatever they were comfortable with.
So you bared as much as you dared?
Dick out.
Congratulations. You've completed the circuit. You've made a big splash, grabbed some newspaper headlines, and probably a spot on the 6 o'clock news. Everyone is ready to hop off their bikes and kick back. Step three, time for the after party.
I would encourage that. I think it'd be smart to have like a big sort of celebratory, an after party or something like that. We just went through this ordeal together and we're gonna have fun with it. You know, we had DJ Dick out mixing the tunes beforehand. It would be cool to do something afterwards and have some refreshments and things like that.
What would you want to get out of that?
Well, just I think it would help to cultivate a feeling of accomplishment and let everybody feel like they really did something and maybe have the opportunity for people to chat with one another. I mean, you could do a formal, like, what did people like about this? And I think that that's always valuable. Some people find those kinds of things tedious and you have a hard time getting certain people engaged if that's not what they signed up for. But I think that by creating a space for people to just hang out with their clothes on, off, or whatever, you're naturally going to have some sort of dialogue between friends and new friends and strangers talking about what that experience was like. And I think just to create a space where people can just sort of reflect on that is useful.
And that's about it. Our three-step guide to putting together a naked bike ride for World Naked Bike Ride Day. I don't know if I'm totally ready to jump on board yet. I mean, I'm passionate about cycling. Am I passionate enough to bear all for the cause? Well, if you're like me and still searching for that extra bit of inspiration, I'm just going to leave you with Ben's closing words to help put the importance of this cycling cause in perspective.
Well, you know, one thing I will say is that I do a lot of touring in Europe, and they really, really put us to shame. Well, you know, there's bike paths between cities. There's bike paths along all of the major arteries. And in cities like Amsterdam, you know, there aren't bike paths anywhere because the road is for bikers, and the cars are the ones who have to negotiate the bikes, not vice versa. Our country was built, you know, roughly contemporaneously with cars, and the expansion of our cities, the birth of suburbia, all of these things. I don't think that it's impossible for us to reclaim the streets for sustainable transportation, but it's going to take political will, it's going to take leadership, and it doesn't look like the political class really gives a but I think that the more that people decide that bikes are going to be a priority, and the more that people push our officials for sustainable transportation, you know, at a certain point they won't have a choice. And it's a matter of us exercising our democratic rights and our obligation as citizens in a democracy to demand the kind of society that we want to live in. And so I think that biking is just one of these issues, but I think it's a very, very important one. And I hope that things like the Naked Bike Ride will help to galvanize movement.
Thank you, Ben and Trevor, for putting together that how-to guide to naked bike riding. Now you're all set to start up a ride in your own city. And you can always get in touch with your local community bike shop or cycling association for some more tips. If you want more from Ben Kaplan, you can find all his links up on our website. A Fierce Green Fire is a documentation of approximately 5 decades worth of eco-activism. Based on a book by the same title, author Philip Shapkoff appears throughout the film sharing the American perspective of spectacular events that garnered change through solidarity and media. From the dams of the Grand Canyon to the Kyoto Protocol, here are my thoughts on the star-powered documentary. A Fierce Green Fire is not a film that's about climate change, but more so about the events that have led us to this place, where ideologies have trumped scientific evidence in decision-making and how solidarity and activism is at the core of fighting such injustice. I seem biased already, but bear with me. I'll get out of the way that the star power narrating's documentary is not distracting, as I'd initially assumed. Each celebrity narrates one of 5 parts, or acts, as they call it, the last main climate change, which is at where we're at right now, where the film ends. So you can assume that this is a very simplistic way of presenting something very complex. In saying that, the film is edited well, nothing special, general talking head juxtaposed with archival footage, which is what makes this sort of film kind of redundant. But I could go on about aesthetics. It's really a great reference for the spectacular environmental events that have taken place over 50 years. Starting with the Sierra Club and David Bauer's revelation of when the world saw the Earth from space for the first time, or Lois Gibbs and her action against the government for pledging ignorance to the Love Canal. There isn't much in the film that seasoned environmentalists don't know already, but it would be time well spent by a teen that stumbles upon and chooses to watch this on YouTube or Netflix. It's a great beginner's guide to media heroes of the movement that it could breed new young activists. Something the film shows as normal in archival footage, something I think we really need for this film not to be forgotten as just another film about saving the planet.
Do you ever wonder why some authors can make their words ring out and sizzle right off the page, but others, not so much? Tara informer Chris Chang-Yan Phillips has been curious for a while about the difference between two writers from the early days of the American conservation movement, Alda Leopold and John Muir. What gives Leopold's book so much poetry and fire?
Coincidentally, while snowshoeing with ecology grad students Paul Sagan and Sonia Odson, he overheard them talking about this very question.
I read something from it. Wasn't the Sound County Almanac? It was something shorter in
like
school.
The land ethic? Is that what
Yeah.
Or was that just a subject?
Subject.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the land ethic was a subject in his book, and it was really probably the most important idea that he introduced in that book, which really extended ethics to the natural world. It was the first time it was ever done to actually, you know, say that a community is not just a community of humans, but a community of all the living creatures, the soils, and the productive capacity of the land, and extending values to those, the entities, in as much as they sustain us, but for also their inherent value too. So
how did you get to reading that?
Coming from Wisconsin, in the environmental program I started out in, Leopold was often referenced because of his upbringing in the state, and because in his book he often used, for example, creatures, you know, from the regional ecological community. And so it was just part of the curriculum in my environmental education. But in reading him more kind of outside of that curriculum, it really kind of dawned on me that this was an enjoyable thing beyond just learning facts and figures about nature, but finding a relationship in a kind of a poetic way, a narrative with which to view it. So a mixture of kind of, I don't know, poetry and science, in a sense.
No, which book were you guys saying that you hated?
Well, I didn't hate. I can't remember the title. It was John Muir, and like he's like the father of conservation, I think.
Yeah.
Most of what I remember from this stuff is from Scott Nielsen's classes.
He founded the U.S. Sierra Club, right?
That's
right.
That
sounds right, yeah. But he's just, his writing is very prosy and flowery, and I think it's just a generational thing. I just had a lot of trouble getting through it, and I had to put it down.
But that's funny, because Alda Leopold is also not of our generation.
That is interesting, yeah. Too. You know, he was a little bit more recent. I think that might have played into it, and did have an academic background. You know, Muir was a big fan of the transcendental writers. He met Emerson at one point when they were in Yosemite, and the young Muir, full of life and enthusiasm, who had such zeal to go camping for 2 weeks straight in the Sierras and bring nothing but a little hunk of bread and some tea, saw Emerson, who came by in a carriage, you know, led by a horse with some prominent Washington, D.C. folks, and tried to encourage Emerson to come out with him and come experience the land and come to the cathedral forest. And in leaving, was so disappointed that Emerson wouldn't kind of budge in his old rigidity, that he wouldn't come out and experience with him. And it, you know, Muir, I think, understood why, in a sense, but was also really disappointed after leaving that interaction. So maybe, you know, his connection to the transcendental writers might have played into his writing style too.
Feel free to quote Paul on everything. He knows what he's talking about. I'm reaching back to memories from like second year of university, which was very long.
Yeah, I think I read some of this stuff like 4 years ago too.
Yeah, it's mad fuzzy.
there was something really intriguing, I feel, about John Muir, and it comes back to a common linkage between both him and Alda Leopold. Both of them actually had quite roots in my home state, Wisconsin. John Muir, a Scottish immigrant who came over at age 5 with a stern father who was a minister of Calvinism. Grew up in the state, down in the Baraboo region, which is an area of rolling hills and pine forest. After he studied at Madison, he went out to do a number of pursuits, odd jobs, what have you, ended up years later in San Francisco and finally took a trip out to the Sierra Nevadas, out to what at the time was not Yosemite National Park, but would soon be under his efforts. When he got there, he found a landscape that was so big and so grand that it was almost intimidating for him, coming from his background of these soft rolling hills in the state of Wisconsin with small trees, where instead he found huge mountains, not hills, and gigantic trees, not 100-foot tall ones. And it took a while for it to grow on him, but eventually it did, and he certainly never went back to the Midwest. But I do feel kindred with him, and that his upbringing was from the upper Midwest.
That was Chris Chang-Yun Phillips asking ecologists Paul Sagan and Sonia Odson about the works of American authors Aldo Leopold and John Muir.
Scrambled, poached, sunny side up, whether they came before the chicken or the chicken before them, eggs are a breakfast staple. Terra Informa's Nicole Weird brings us an eco-babble, where she enlists some local farmers to try to break down the term free range. It's just one of the many terms that you can find on a carton of eggs, but as you'll soon find out, defining free range is not as simple as it sounds.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural images.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable energy.
Eco-babble.
It may seem pretty self-explanatory, but the term free range is anything but easy to define. Free range doesn't mean organic. It means the animals have access to outside spaces. But where the confusion really comes from is the lack of a legal standard. A farm can falsely claim they produce free-range eggs without getting into trouble. Unlike organic, there is no law to decide what's free-range and what isn't. Ideally, free-range hens would be wandering around on a green grass utopia, scratching up dirt and roosting in trees, but typically the hens are kept uncaged inside barns with some degree of outdoor access. But the amount, duration, and quality of their free-range has no standards. The birds can be fed whatever the farmers decide to feed them, let out whenever the farmers decide to let them out, and practices such as beak cutting and forced molting through starvation still happens. Yet the egg cartons can still have the highly respected and sought-after free-range sticker on them. So I headed down to the Strathcona Farmers Market in Edmonton to ask some farmers about how they define free-range.
I'm Sheila Hamilton from Sunworks Farm down by Armina.
In terms of free range, there isn't really a definition, but if you were to define it, how would you define it?
I would define it as I feel it should be defined, and that is with more than ample room to run and onto fresh vegetation or fresh grass or whatever you want to put them on at a constant rate. So moved every day and not just out on a little tiny piece that they can say yes, they go outside. It should be true free range.
Do you think it should be like a legal definition?
I think it should be, just as they need to define what natural means. There's no meaning for natural, there's no meaning for free range. There's just all these words that are used out there that really have no definitions.
Marius de Boer, and I'm owner-operator of Four Whistle Farm out by Millet, Alberta.
Okay, and your eggs and your animals are free range?
Yeah.
Yeah? How do you define that?
I guess in the winter, actually, we maybe shouldn't call it free range, but everybody does. It's free run in the winter. Of course, the chickens don't get to go outside in the winter. In the summer, they do. So they have access to outside areas. That's and in the barn, so they're not in cages. They're obviously running loose in the barn on shavings with lots of room and sunlight in the barn as well.
Do you think there should be a legal standard for free range, like there is for organic?
Yeah, I guess I always believe in the good of the people, so I wouldn't use it if I couldn't use it, all right? But I suppose it wouldn't hurt. I don't know how they would enforce it, but anyway.
Do you think there are farms that use the label free range but are not actually practicing?
No, not that I know of any.
Interesting side note, in Australia, there's been a recent change to the way that free range is defined. Previously, free range meant 1,500 hens per hectare. Now, the number has increased to 10,000 hens per hectare. This allows for up to 12 hens per square meter, provided they are within 9 meters of an exit. Imagine this. Your average bathroom is 6 square meters. Under Australian regulations, that's enough space for 72 chickens. And as long as they have access to a right outside, these sardined hens would be considered free range. I hope this gives you something to think about. Next time you grab that carton of eggs, picture your bathroom overflowing with chickens, and remember, it's always best to check with the farmer themselves to see how they define free range.
That was Nicole Weird with this week's EcoBabble.
Before we go, here's this week's edition of What's Happening.
On August 9th, the Stanley Park Ecology Society, or SPEC, will be leading a walk along the intertidal zone starting at Vancouver Stanley Park Pavilion.
From armored sea cucumbers to red-feathered duster worms, this waterside wonderland is supposed to be an out-of-this-world experience. So bring your curiosity and a good pair of rubber boots.
The walk runs from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. and the cost is only $10, $5 for SPEC members.
This Saturday, August 8th, travel to Qualicum Beach to support local artists as they paint, sketch, and photograph Milner Gardens.
Even if you don't necessarily like art, come for the live music, tea room, or the silent auction.
You can visit between 10 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. on Saturday or Sunday. For more information on the Milner Gardens art show, visit viu.ca.
For more information, you can visit our website, terrainforma.ca. Do you like worms? Or dirt? Or do you like the thought of rotting fruit and veg?
We do!
The City of Winnipeg is offering a low-cost, Water and Waste Department-funded Master Composting course. It takes place in September, but the deadline is August 25th to apply. The Green Action Centre is hosting the 12-hour composting program that teaches the details of composting, including sessions on soil health, compost maturity, biology of the compost pile, and vermicomposting activities, to name a few.
You'll also get a manual that contains in-depth composting information, but you must be 18 or over to apply. For more information, check out greenactioncentre.ca.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this week's show.
Thanks to our contributors, Trevor Chow Fraser, Chris Chang Yan Phillips, and Nicole Weird.
Hamdi for website and coordination.
And our producer, Chris Chang Yan Phillips.
Terra Informa is produced at CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton. If you have questions or comments, send us an email to terra@cjsr.com. You can find us on Twitter at Terra Informa.
We've been your hosts, Dasmi Anishat.
And Natalie Ramath. Catch you next week.